Good morning and welcome to Behind the Headlines. This is a weekly Utah news roundup featuring journalists from the Salt Lake Tribune and heard every Friday here on KCPW. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the program, housing caseworkers decry what they say is a blacklist of prospective renters maintained by a powerful Utah law firm. A newly released database shows that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is the fifth largest private landholder in the United States. And the Utah Jazz square off against the Dallas Mavericks in the first round of the NBA playoffs. We will get a preview of that. And joining me for this conversation here in studio, we've got Salt Lake Tribune news columnist Robert Gerke. Robert, thanks for being here. Always a pleasure.
Hey, good to see you.
Yeah, good to see you as well. And on the Zoom, we have got Tribune real estate reporter reporter Tony Semerad. And Tony, thanks for joining us. Welcome.
Hey, everybody.
And let's see, listeners, just a reminder that you can join the show with your questions and comments by tweeting them to @KCPW or calling 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. And later in the show, we're going to hear from Utah Jazz beat writer Andy Larson. And in just a moment, we will turn to government reporter Bethany Rogers. In fact, we will do that right now. Numerous Utah renters say that they're on a blacklist maintained by a powerful Draper law firm, and some of them saying that being included on that list has blocked them from securing housing. Reporter Bethany Rogers wrote the story on this, and here now is our conversation.
Bethany Rogers, thanks for being here. I really appreciate it.
Of course.
Housing caseworkers and property managers say that a powerful Utah law firm keeps a database of renters, sometimes even called a blacklist. And Bethany, can you just explain what this is, what this list is, and who is apparently maintaining it?
The law offices of Kirk Cullimore apparently maintain this database. They are the largest law firm in the state handling or representing landlords and handle almost half of Utah's eviction cases. So they really kind of have a real hold on this side of the law in Utah. And for a long time, tenants have been complaining that they feel that this law firm, that they feel that they've been placed on some sort of a blacklist. They feel like they can't get a new apartment, that, you know, every time they put in an application, they're denied. But to this point, the law offices of Kirk Cullimore have denied that they maintain any such blacklist. Now, just recently, through some reporting, we found that it does, in fact, keep a database of tenant information. So that might be where they were drawing that distinction previously. But they do acknowledge that they keep information about tenants on file and that they share it, this information, with their landlord clients during some application processes. It's not entirely clear what's contained in the database. The law firm itself told me that they only keep track of things that are already in the public record. So you can, you know, look up eviction cases right now if you go onto the Utah court's website on Exchange, and you can find that information there. So they say all they're really sharing with their landlord clients who request information about a particular person is whether or not they've been involved in litigation with this particular person. And they also pass along the name of the landlord who was involved, who may have been involved in that eviction case or other litigation.
And again, they're the largest representer, legal representative of law firms in the state. And so, you know, whether or not they have been in litigation with a prospective renter is something that they would obviously have. They would be collecting. They act as a collections agency often for landlords. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. So that's kind of their business model. They apparently, you know, charge very low rates to their clients. But then on the other side, when they do an eviction case, they act as the debt collector later on and kind of go after the people who were evicted for these debts, which can really kind of balloon very quickly from just maybe a few $100s of back rent to, you know, people down the line say that they've been contacted about debts that exceed $10,000 that they don't even know that they had.
How does that happen, that ballooning, you know, compounding debt issue? It's what's the process by which a person can rack up that much debt as a renter?
Yeah, so it's a combination of just the interest on the debt, and then also as part of Utah's eviction process, you know, tenants are noticed that they need to be out by a certain date. And if they overstay that, they are charged what's called treble damages, which is three times the fees and prorated, you know, daily rent for every day that they overstay. So that debt can go up, you know, can really skyrocket quite rapidly.
You write in your article that this law firm, you know, the law offices of Kirk Cullimore, denies that it keeps a quote unquote blacklist. But advocates for renters and social workers trying to help the homeless, they say that is how this list is used, right? I mean, explain how they believe the list is being used. What's the sort of process they say is happening? A landlord contacts the Cullimore law office, and then what happens?
Yeah, so I first kind of began digging into this story when I met a former caseworker, housing caseworker named Braden Jenks. And he came to me very frustrated. He had just left, you know, the nonprofit where he had served as a housing case manager, working with individuals experiencing homelessness. And he just said that he had read the Tribune's past reporting on a blacklist and started to become suspicious because he read up on, you know, tenants' rights, the federal law about what tenants can request. And so when his clients were denied rental housing, he discovered that he had the right to ask on what basis they were denied and then to produce sort of, you know, a background check or credit history that was used in making that determination. And he ran into repeatedly, time after time after time, situations where the property managers would say your client was denied because of a past eviction. And he would look through the credit check and he would see that no eviction appeared on it. And so he was wondering where they would get this, they were getting this information from. And he said about 8 to 10 people openly acknowledged that that information had not come from the credit check as they initially had represented, but it was actually coming from this Cullimore database. They had gone, you know, contacted the law firm and asked them, you know, given them the applicant's name and found out that that applicant had been involved in litigation with the law firm in the past. And he said that, you know, since the Cullimores represent so many landlords, that he knew the instant they were denied from one rental property that was represented by the Cullimore firm, that they were basically locked out of any housing or most housing in the Salt Lake City area, certainly any that were represented by the law office.
Jenks says, you know, he's working to try and get homeless people into stable housing. And he says he has a couple of quotes in your article that I found to be really interesting. One was, when they get that hope and then there's still someone putting up a bureaucratic fence in front of them, it's extremely discouraging and they feel completely helpless. The law firm, as you point out, says that they're just providing publicly available information to landlords, but that doesn't amount to a list that they maintain of people that landlords shouldn't rent to. You know, maybe we should describe the fact that evictions, the mark of evictions, really is a significant barrier to people to getting housing again. If they have been evicted once, that can really stick on their record, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's really kind of a huge stigma for people. In fact, this quote didn't make it into the article, but I was talking to one other caseworker who told me that it's almost as difficult to get a client with an eviction into housing as it is to get a client who's a registered sex offender into housing. It's that much of a barrier for people. And so I just spoke to person after person for this article who sort of confirmed that evictions, even ones that were many, many years old, were standing between them and finding any sort of rental housing. You know, in one case, that caseworker actually named Allie that I just mentioned, she gave up on her apartment search. You know, after turning her life around, paying off all of her debts, she, you know, got improved her credit score bit by bit over the years. And her eviction wasn't showing up on her credit history. So she thought she was in the clear to finally find rental housing on her own and was just completely shut out and is still living with her parents as a result. So, and you know, she points out that she's one of the lucky ones. She has a supportive family to be able to be there for her in that situation, but many people don't have that.
Right. And as a result, might end up staying on the streets longer than otherwise they they would. You know, I guess a question that I have is that that eviction mark, is that sort of a permanent mark? I mean, isn't, I think what I'm trying to ask you about here, Bethany, is there's a federal law that requires a purging of information pertaining to evictions. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, and that's one of the things that people brought up when we were talking about this database, this private database, as being potentially problematic, is that, you know, there are federal consumer protection laws that apply specifically to companies that conduct background checks and tenant screenings and things like that. And they require those groups to sort of, you know, purge a person's eviction or other negative information about them after a certain period of time. You know, for a lot of negative information, that time period is 7 years. And it also gives consumers other protections, such as, you know, as I mentioned earlier, the right to see the report, to see the credit check that was used in making a certain decision about them, and also to contest information that they believe is inaccurate. So say an eviction shows up and they say, no, I was never evicted, that's incorrect, then they would have the right to go back and correct the record, set the record straight.
Sorry, I don't mean to cut you off, but do any of those requirements apply to what the Kirk Cullimore law firm does with its list?
Well, one law expert that I talked to said that that would be a gray area, that the law firm certainly seems like it might be acting as a backgrounding or tenant screening entity that might fall under these consumer protection laws. But, you know, in correspondence, Kirk Cullimore Sr. told me that he doesn't believe that they're acting in that capacity and doesn't believe that those laws would apply.
Hmm. Kirk Cullimore Sr., Kirk Cullimore Jr., the son, who also works at this law firm, is also a state senator. And there is a law that he helped author that is about expunging records here in Utah of renters. Can you talk about that? Isn't there a way for renters to get evictions expunged from their records? I mean, beyond the federal requirements?
No, it before this last year, there was no way for someone to get those court records removed. There was no path for that.
Court records. Sorry.
Yeah.
And the court records are records of an eviction. Is that what the court records
are? An eviction case, yeah. Correct. Or other. Okay. Yeah, exactly. A record of an eviction case. So that would have remained in the court system indefinitely, even though, you know, it's not really clear how often landlords are going to the court website to look people up. It seems that they more often use, you know, credit checks, consumer reporting agencies, stuff like that, and also the Cullimores. But yeah, so this year, in an attempt to sort of create that path forward, Representative Maura Judkins sponsored legislation that that would allow for a process in cases where all the person's debts were settled, so they would have to, you know, pay off whatever they owed as a result of the eviction. And after that, could, you know, submit an application to a judge to have that purged from their record. And, you know, if there were no objection to that, then that would be allowed. So there is a path for those to be removed. And Kirk Cullimore Sr. pointed out that another piece of the bill would also require consumer reporting agencies to remove from their records as well evictions that had been purged from the public record. And Kirk Cullimore Sr. says that he doesn't believe, again, that his office falls under that definition and doesn't believe that they would have to, as a result of the bill, expunge someone. But he says, since they are just sharing publicly available information, that information, once it's purged from the court system, wouldn't be available anyway.
Hmm. I guess, Bethany, this is some very in-depth reporting, and I'm going to encourage listeners to check it out over at sltrip.com. But I'm wondering if there's anything that we didn't touch on in this reporting that you'd like for us to know about before I let you go.
Well, I guess the one other thing that I would have wanted to mention is that eviction judgments last for a very long period of time right now, that they are automatically last for 8 years, and they can be renewed for another 8. So a total of 16 years that this can stay on someone's record, unless under this new legislation, they were able to get it expunged. So also want to add that people experiencing homelessness are surveyed when they check into a shelter or other services. And that I believe about 1,000 of them said that they were homeless as a result of an eviction. So quite a number of people point to eviction as a direct cause of their homelessness in Utah.
Can I ask you one just follow up there, which is you said the fact that there's an eviction on your record can be renewed for an additional 8 years. What does that mean? Or who does that renewing?
Yeah, my understanding would be that it would be in the case of the Cullimores, say the Cullimores firm is representing you, that they could go back and ask for that judgment to be renewed so that they could continue trying to collect on that debt.
Got it. Okay. Thank you. Clarifying point, and I really appreciate it. And I appreciate the reporting as well. And just before you go, I'll say that I believe that this will be your last ever appearance on this show as you're leaving the Salt Lake Tribune. And let me just say what I said on Twitter, Bethany, which is that we have all benefited from your reporting. And thank you very much for doing it. Thanks for joining us today as well.
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure being on the show.
And again, that's Bethany Rogers reporting on this apparent, you know, alleged blacklist for renters and how it plays into perhaps perpetuating homelessness for some Utahns. That is, I think, the gist of her reporting. Robert Gerke, what do you think of this report that Bethany did on the way that landlords interact with this this law firm?
Yeah, I mean, it covers a lot of ground in there, but I think that, you know, if you take a step back, what we can see from this is that we already knew that the system is really hard on people who are have been evicted or are facing an eviction. This just shows one more way that the system is stacked against them. I mean, even if they have all of their things in order, you know, if they've gone through something like this and they have everything in order, they have their deposits and so forth, they could still get rejected because they're on this, you know, private database. And as you mentioned in there, there are court records, but then there are these private records and we don't really know what's in there. They don't know what's in there. They don't know why they're getting rejected for this. Except in that case where the advocate found out that they had been rejected because of this database.
Right.
You know, I think it's always troubling when private organizations are gathering data on us, you know, but I think especially when it could impact your opportunities to get a house or a roof over your head, it's a real problem.
Yeah, I mean, the law firm says it's just providing publicly available information. And of course, landlords just, you know, they want to find the perfect tenant, an Eagle Scout who's got a 4.0 GPA and lots of money.
Sure. And in this market, they have lots to choose from, too. So, you know, it makes sense for on some level that they're going to be as give as much scrutiny as they can to all of these, use all the tools at their disposal. But, you know, you need to have an opportunity to move on from something like an eviction, and this makes it a little bit more difficult, or a lot more difficult for some people to do that.
It's hard to get past the past. Meanwhile, the cost of renting in this town, in this valley, in this state has been rising. And Tony Semerad, on the Zoom, you are the real estate reporter, and I know that you've reported on how much the rents have been rising, and it's a significant increase, isn't it?
Well, absolutely. I mean, we're at a absolute historic all-time high for vacancy rates, below 2% in Salt Lake County. So for some perspective, out of about 150,000 rental units, maybe 3,000 are vacant at any given time. The estimate on rent increases year over year, most recently, is about 20%. I think the average rental, a two-bedroom unit in Salt Lake County, is at about $2,150 or more per month. And, you know, just as a reminder, roughly a third of Utahns rent these days. And you know, recent data indicates that up to maybe 40% or more of renters are spending more than a third of their income on housing and utilities, and that puts you right up against the financial edge. There's something like 20% of all renters that are spending more than half of their income on rent.
Wow. I'm a question about the vacancies is, you know, how much of those apartments that are vacant are actually sort of investment properties, things that people buy and then don't rent out. Is that data that we can ever get?
Well, you know, that's a different, difficult picture to get at. Just,
sure.
You know, there's no question that the sort of short-term rental effect is having a, you know, a big impact on housing supply around here. And you know, remember, if you're you know, the average Utahn, you're either renting, you're living with relatives, or you're buying a home. Home prices, especially single family homes, have just skyrocketed over the last 10 years. And so with interest rates going up, there really is a kind of an emerging squeeze on most Utahns.
I'm, as far as this, just going back to the story that Bethany reported, and I don't know if Robert, you can comment on this if you want or not, but I'm curious if the, you know, for the list, as far as that list goes, is if the information that it contains gets around the expungement of eviction or court records that Bethany reported on. I mean, I have no idea because I haven't seen the database, but if the stigma of an eviction persists because of this list, that could be contributing to ongoing homelessness where we live. It's hard to know. Yeah. We do have to head to another break in the show, but any final comments here, Gricky, before we move on? We're going to come back to real estate, land holdings of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Yeah, I mean, I just think it, as Tony hit on, I think it shows the predicament that anybody who is looking for an apartment or a home is facing right now in this state. And, you know, it doesn't show any signs of abating anytime soon, I think.
Okay. With that, we will head to our first break in the show. And when we come back, as I said, we will stay in the realm of real estate and a report on the land holdings of the LDS Church. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stay with us.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
And welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune real estate reporter Tony Semerad and by news columnist Robert Gierke. This is our live Friday morning Utah News Roundup. You can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. Or you can tweet them to @KCPW. Tony Semerad, you reported this week on a new database tracking the land holdings of the Utah-based Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Let's get the top line story first. How much land and real estate are we talking about that the church owns?
Well, yeah, so this is probably the widest look we've had yet at the holdings of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. This tally of about 16,000 properties nationwide adds up to a total of about $16 billion in estimated market value, a total of 1.7 million acres nationwide, which would rank the church among the top five private landowners in the country.
Wow.
You know, among many very striking things about this glimpse at what they hold, it is the sort of sheer ubiquity of these properties. You look at them mapped and they spread entirely across the country, in Hawaii and Alaska and the 48 domestic states. Just a stunning collection of properties, every sizable metropolitan area, every state and huge kind of rural agricultural properties in between.
Agricultural properties, rural properties, cities. I mean, what are the sorts of lands and property that we are talking about? It's not just, you know, tracts of land. There's buildings. I mean, in Florida, you in your article, it points out that the church is the largest landowner in that state, right? What does that land look like?
Yeah, well, so this database sort of spans out from about a core of about $8 billion in, you know, what you'd expect, meaning houses and temples and places of worship. But it extends to, you know, office towers. There are shopping centers, residential skyscrapers, and as you note, these absolutely immense agricultural operations, you know, cattle ranches and farms. And in Florida in particular, where the church owns an estimated 2% or more of the state's entire landmass, you've got these vast pasture lands south of Orlando and a couple of collections of properties in the panhandle that are, you know, in the hundreds of thousands of acres. And, you know, it's not just Florida. There are a number under the church company's ag reserve and farmland reserve. There are similarly large tracts of land, you know, in Iowa and Texas and Illinois. And, you know, part of a big component of this is agricultural lands. But, you know, there are also a lot of commercial properties and quite lucrative ones.
Right. Apartment towers in Philadelphia and Chicago, office buildings in big cities worth hundreds of millions of dollars. You know, I want to know, I'd like to, you say that they're the fifth largest landowner. I'd like to know who the top four are. But before we do that, maybe I can ask you where this information is coming from. How was this data compiled?
So interestingly, this was compiled by a group currently called Truth and Transparency Foundation. Most people may have heard of them under the name of Mormon Leaks. They've been around since 2016. They were the two co-founders, Ryan McKnight and Ethan Gregory Dodge, captured this data about 2 years ago. It was early 2020, and a picture of, you know, the sort of land holdings as of 2019. They sort of worked on it and refined the data. And then, of course, like us all, they were severely disrupted by the pandemic. And but they'd been kind of, you know, making this data more accurate and rechecking it. And then as a sort of a departing gesture, the foundation is closing down. They released it last week.
Departing gesture, they're meaning the Mormon Leaks, the group, I'm sorry, the Truth and Transparency, is that what it was? Foundation?
Yeah, Truth and Transparency Foundation. Yeah.
They are ceasing operations?
They are closing down for a number of you know, reasons unrelated to this. You know, they've had some sort of, you know, personal things come up and some financial challenges for the foundation, and they've, you know, decided to kind of move on. This group had grabbed headlines over the last couple of years, kind of, you know, flowing from what you might impute from their name. At the time, Mormon Leaks, they had been a conduit of leaked documents and did kind of impact journalism around that, related to the LDS Church and other faiths. They got sued by the Jehovah's Witnesses, and it ended up pretty much crippling them financially. And it was, you know, one of the reasons why they're shutting down.
I think Robert Gerke has a question for you here.
Yeah, can you remind me, and I guess tell our listeners about the tax status of this? Church obviously is tax exempt, but I think some of this is not tax exempt. Can you kind of?
That's right. The vast majority of it, you know, and just to back up a little bit, this is drawn from county property records across the country, and you know, the vast majority of this property is defined as tax exempt. You know, and estimated somewhere around 11 to 12 billion of the $16 billion total is classified as tax exempt under, you know, them being religious properties. But, you know, a decent maybe 3 to 4 billion in the portfolio, maybe 2.8, something like that, is commercial. And it's owned by for-profit entities that are in turn owned by the church, companies like, you know, Private Reserve and Suburban Land Reserve, or Property Reserve, I should say, and Suburban Land Reserve, companies like that.
But the other 13.2 billion or whatever, that would be tax exempt of their holdings?
Yes. Okay. That's correct. Hmm. And, you know, there's also, you know, again, oftentimes in especially rural counties, agricultural property can be kind of, you know, classified at a lower kind of tax rate too. So if you add in, you know, special purpose properties and some of those vacant lands, the extent to which it's tax exempt is even higher.
What does the church say about its land and real estate holdings? Why it has, I mean, I think we can all understand why it has temples and meeting houses and the like, but what about in terms of vast tracts of land in places like Florida, or as you said, across the continent, from, you know, high mountain holdings to farmland, et cetera. What do they say about why they do that?
Well, you know, they characterize it as an extension of their religious mission. As you note, you know, these places, making these places of worship available. But, you know, this is also a component of their welfare and kind of humanitarian operations. And, you know, in an interesting sort of dynamic with Salt Lake City, there's also this imperative, according to the church, of preserving sacred lands or lands around their sacred sites. So akin to kind of City Creek Center in downtown Salt Lake, where, you know, the church has built about a $2 billion sort of shopping center and residential center, that's meant to sort of protect the, you know, property around the Salt Lake Temple. And so we see similar kind of echoes of that in places like Philadelphia and Mesa, Arizona, where the church is moving to kind of preserve the land around their sacred sites. Hmm.
Again, I mentioned that it's the fifth largest landowner, I mean, this is in your reporting, in the United States, who are a private landholder. Who are the other four? Are they churches? What are the other entities that own more land than the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints?
Well, the number one, according to a tally that's kept by a publication called The Land Report, which tracks, you know, land holdings by the nation's wealthiest families. The number one is this California-based company called Sierra Pacific Industries, which is very timber-oriented. It's right. a third-generation-owned company with about $2.3 million in timberland. Businessman and philanthropist John Malone of Telecommunications Inc. of yore owns about $2.2 million, and then they're Ted Turner of CNN is also in the mix. I think he's in at number four with about 2 million acres.
Yeah. Okay. So, and then the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Maybe I'll bring in the news columnist Robert Gerke. I mean, I'm trying to think about. There's this report the group that is the Truth and Transparency Foundation has released, and I think that they have a purpose for releasing the information. But, you know, to you, or I guess, why does this information matter to people, you know, or matter at all?
Yeah, I mean, the thing that I think was most interesting about this is that we knew the church owned a lot of Utah, right?
Yeah.
And as Utahns, we can see it all the time. We see the church's holdings all the time. I don't think, and we knew they owned, obviously, temples, churches around the country, around the world, actually. But I don't think we understood the scope and breadth of what they hold in terms of commercial buildings and things like that. So I thought that was really just fascinating.
Yeah.
At a time when the church has come under some criticism for its stock portfolio, you know, its vast stock portfolio, and the revenue that generates for the church. I think this kind of calls into question, and that's why I asked the question of Tony about the tax status of some of this, because
yep.
some of it is clearly not related to the church's mission as a church. And so, you know, you start to question whether it's a church or whether it's a multi-billion-dollar business.
Tony, did the Truth and Transparency Foundation in your reporting talk about why they were doing this digging?
Well, you know, it's one of their core values or, you know, missions in terms of religious accountability to provide this, transparency. And they make no bones about this being, you know, in large part directed at church members to kind of, let them know and bring transparency to the equation. You know, one important thing to note about this is it is almost guaranteed to be an undercount.
Right.
Yeah, this draws on, a select maybe, you know, 6 to 10 known companies that the church owns property under, but doesn't get at what we know are a number of other companies through which the church owns property. Single family residential is not included in this, and we know the church owns some of those, but we don't know how much. And there are other reasons to think that this is kind of a partial glimpse. And then if you take in the fact that they own, massive amounts of land in countries like the United Kingdom and Australia and that sort of thing, we know this is, again, just kind of a glimpse.
Well, it's interesting. I wonder if we did
get that information clarified, how much higher up in the list they would go in terms of land holdings in the United States. And Tony, I guess I'll ask you the same question I asked Bethany, which is there anything from the story that we're missing that you think needs including? You brought up that last point that that it's an undercount, but anything from the story that that we didn't get to?
Well, I think, one of the questions this sort of raises is what role does the church play in a number of ongoing conversations related to this? So for example, these massive ranch lands that they own produce, incredible amounts of, beef. Is there a conversation there? Are there conversations about climate change with regard to how they develop these properties? And we tallied up something like 180,000 acres of open lands in suburban areas. And so the church will play a significant role in how the country develops now that we're kind of on a home construction spurt. And, there's some indication that, do they play a role in the conversations about urban development and that sort of thing? Mm-hmm. It raises a lot of interesting questions.
It's great reporting, and you can check it out at sltrib.com. And Tony Semerad is real estate reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. We really appreciate you filling us in on this. And now on the show, because we're saving time for a conversation with Salt Lake Tribune jazz beat writer Andy Larson, we are going to already turn to our underplayed segments of the week. Robert Gierke, why don't I kick things off by asking you for your pick for underplayed story?
I thought you wanted to talk to me about the jazz playoffs. I'm looking forward to that.
I am too. I'm excited. Tomorrow.
My story is definitely not underplayed, but I think it's an important one. This morning, CNN obtained some text messages from Senator Mike Lee to Mark Meadows, who was Donald Trump's chief of staff, sent by Senator Lee after the election, and it was they revolve around the efforts to discredit the election and to find alternate electors that they could then challenge and contest the election. I think it's worth looking at because it does kind of poke some holes in the narrative that Senator Lee had established, and it's been one of the big questions I think that a lot of us have had since the election was what role did Senator Lee play in the efforts to overturn the election, and so it's worth checking out. There's a story by Brian Schott at sltrib.com now that summarizes some of those.
Yeah, the headline is, "Please tell me what I should be saying." Text messages show Senator Mike Lee assisting Trump efforts to overturn 2020 election. That's over at sltrib.com. And sort of underplayed because I hadn't seen it until the show kicked off. But not underplayed for long. Tony Semerad, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
Well, it's not as if Utah's epic drought is really underplayed, but I think we're distracted by other more dire crises. But Tuesday, Salt Lake City Mayor Aaron Mendenhall announced that the city's going to its sort of peak demand strategy for water this early in the year, asking residents to, take shorter showers and repair leaks in the irrigation systems and cut back at least 5% voluntarily to reduce water use. And I fear this portends a pretty dry summer.
Wow. Great pick from Tony Semerad, and thank you for that. For my part, for my underplayed story, I'm going to go with a story actually that was from last week, the walkout by West High students over HB 11, the bill banning transgender girls from participating in female school sports. And I was at East High School in 1995 or 96 when there was a walkout over legislative action aimed at the extracurricular gay-straight alliance. And that walkout was kind of a formative moment in my youth. I couldn't help but see this past week's walkout, that action by West High students through the lens of that history more than a quarter century ago now, though it doesn't feel like it. Anyway, that is my pick. And with that, we will say goodbye to my guests, Tony Semerad and Robert Gierke, both with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thank you so much for joining me on Behind the Headlines today.
Hey, thank you.
Hey, thanks.
Of course. We're going to take another break in the show. And then when we come back, a Utah Jazz playoff preview with Andy Larson. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stick around.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW Salt Lake Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW. And now on the show, we'll turn to my conversation with Salt Lake Tribune Utah Jazz beat writer Andy Larson about the Jazz, a preview of the Jazz playoffs run. Take a listen.
The Utah Jazz are headed to the playoffs. And Andy Larson, before we get to a round one preview, I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about the regular season and how it ended, because the Jazz were doing really well earlier this season, but there was kind of a fizzle towards the end. Do you want to talk about why that happened from your perspective, Andy?
Yeah, the big problem with the team has been losing leads in the fourth quarter. You know, they've gone into a lot of these games with 15, 16, even 17-point leads in the fourth and let those leads slip, including three times in the Jazz's last seven games. So that's kind of been the biggest issue for the team. And, you know, it's that actually means that they lead the league in kind of fourth quarter leads lost. And so that has kind of been the biggest thing that happened over the last couple of weeks in terms of their kind of late playoff slide. But I also want to point out that they went 4-12 in January too, you know, so that was largely COVID and injuries and that kind of thing. But it has just been kind of an up and down season with this team being kind of dependent on health and whether or not they're playing well.
I got to ask, I mean, just on the losing in the fourth quarter becoming kind of a hallmark of the team. I mean, they lost because they lost and because the other team played better. But I'm wondering if you can go any deeper than that on the fourth quarter collapse and why it kept happening.
For sure. You know, I think there are a couple issues in all of these collapses. You know, I think first, for whatever reason, when the game gets into the fourth quarter, kind of to that point in the game, the team changes the way that it plays offense. You know, it becomes more Donovan Mitchell centric. They don't move the ball as much. They're slower in getting the ball across half court. And that means that some of the easy shots, the layups and dunks at the rim, the open corner threes that are a result of kind of good passing and good ball movement kind of go away. And so that the result is harder shots from the Jazz's star players like Donovan, like Bojan Bogdanovic, like Mike Conley. So, you know, I think that's certainly been an issue. And then, you know, there are some other kind of things like transition defense has been less strong. In one of the losses against the Warriors, Klay Thompson was left open from three a number of times, and that's not something that you want to do. So overall, it has just kind of been a lack of focus and kind of a change in emphasis in that fourth quarter. As much as the Jazz have talked about doing the right thing at that most critical period of the game, very frequently they've kind of gone into a shell and played basketball differently than they do in the first three quarters.
Yeah, I mean, you wrote this piece, Andy, that I found really interesting. It was about Donovan Mitchell, you know, just addressing that fourth quarter failure thing. I don't want to say that it was a harsh column that you wrote about him, but it was almost like you were calling him a ball hog, especially towards the end of the game. Was that the gist of it and one of the reasons that you think that the Jazz kept losing in the fourth?
Yeah, to be clear a little bit, you know, I think clearly Donovan had a proclivity for taking bad shots in the fourth quarter of some of these losses and did not have a very good shooting percentage during the fourth quarter of those losses. So I think that has been certainly an issue. You know, I think ultimately that's something where, you know, if he's able to kind of get off the ball earlier on in the possession, start the possessions earlier, then the Jazz can kind of pass it around a little bit and maybe the ball ends up with Donovan late in the shot clock and he gets an open three or is able to attack a closeout when the defense is on the move. Kind of what problem happens is a little bit is Donovan puts so much pressure on himself, and I think he's well intentioned in doing so, but he does put pressure on himself to kind of change the narrative about the Jazz's fourth quarter losses. And that means that he thinks that he needs to take over the game rather than having success to the team necessarily. So it's one of those tricky balances where he is a Jazz's star player. He is kind of their go-to guy, so to speak. But it is a balance between him taking those shots and finding open shots for other teammates.
Interesting analysis, and thanks, Andy. Let's do dive in on the playoffs. To begin with, the Jazz are facing the Dallas Mavericks. And, you know, saying to begin with actually implies that there's going to be more ahead after that. But what does this matchup look like? What are we paying attention to? Obviously, we want to know whether or not a Dallas Mavericks star player is going to be on the court.
Yeah, so Luka Doncic suffered a left calf strain in the 82nd game of the season, the very last game of the year. And so what that's meant is that his status is up in the air for the series overall, for game one coming up on Saturday. And we really don't know when or if he'll return. That's a big deal because he really is kind of an all NBA level player, definitely one of the top 10 players in the league. And they don't have kind of that secondary star necessarily that you could say would necessarily be able to take on that outsized role if he is out. So That means the Jazz probably want to attack earlier on in the series. And that's meant that Vegas odds makers have favored the Jazz in the series, even though, you know, they had the worst regular season, winning only 49 wins compared to Dallas's 52. So, you know, it's interesting. You know, I think the Jazz are well set up for this series, and obviously health plays a huge role as well. But it is going to be really fascinating to see kind of whether or not the Jazz can get out of their kind of end of season slump and start playing well when it you know, really does matter for the whole game and the playoffs and kind of an elimination situation.
Yeah. And again, the Jazz have not been on the upswing towards the end of the season in the past, you know, dozen or so games. The Mavericks, on the other hand, have been on a bit of a winning streak. Sorry, did you say whether or not Luka Doncic will be playing on the first game? You said no, right? He won't be there, for what we can tell.
We don't know for sure. There was a report from a national reporter saying that he is not expected to play in game one. On Thursday, he did not go through Dallas's practice, but team officials said that he had not yet been ruled out. So we'll see what happens with regards to whether or not he's available. But certainly at this point, it looks unlikely, kind of given the evidence that we have.
Okay. I know we're running low on time here. And Andy Larson, you wrote that the Jazz are especially vulnerable when opposing teams play small ball. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so if teams play without a traditional center, they play kind of what's called five-out basketball with probably five guys outside of the three-point line. The idea is there that whoever does have the ball can kind of then attack that empty space in the middle where the hoop is and attack the space in the paint. So what happened with the Jazz last season is by playing against these five-out teams like the Los Angeles Clippers, they were able to draw Rudy Gobert, the Jazz's best defensive player, outside of the paint. And that meant that the Clippers had kind of these easy paths to the rim where they could get layups and then kickouts for threes or whatever it would be. So the big question, I think, tactically with the Jazz right now is whether or not they can have improved at defending those looks. You know, I think certainly Mike Conley and Donovan Mitchell are more healthy than last year. And so you hope that their lateral movement would be better, that they're able to defend at a higher level. They've also picked up a new defensive player, Daniel House, who I think will play a role in this series, a big role. And then, you know, I think ultimately this team has also faced that look more often this season and kind of practiced to get different options against it. So it's going to be really interesting to see whether or not that is still a weakness of this team in a playoff situation, or whether or not they really have kind of learned from the failures of last year and improved on it to be able to stop it this year.
Andy, the most obvious question in the world, are the Jazz a better team than the Mavericks?
Yes, I think they are. You know, I actually think that you look at, they have two all-stars rather than just the one in Luka Doncic, who's not healthy right now. You've got kind of star level role players, if you will, in Mike Conley and Bojan Bogdanovic that, you know, earn more money and are kind of more successful players and have more a higher pedigree than some of the Mavs role players. I might say that the Mavs are a deeper team, though. You know, I think that they have a lot of really quality, what we call 3-and-D guys who can knock down a three-point shot and can defend as well. So I don't think this will be an easy series either way. Even if Luka Doncic isn't available for the Mavs, you know, even if the Jazz are more talented, I think the Mavs do a lot of things well. They defend well. They shoot the three ball well. They take away three-point shots better than any other team in the NBA, and that's one of the things that the Jazz do best. So, you know, I expect this to be a 6 or 7 game series in kind of either direction, depending on health, and then certainly depending on whether or not the Jazz can overcome some of those tactical and mental issues that we talked about earlier.
Okay. Andy Larson, Salt Lake Tribune Jazz beat reporter. Appreciate your taking the time to explain all of this to us, and go Jazz.
Thanks for having me.
And again, that's Andy Larson. He is Utah Jazz beat reporter over at the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find his coverage and all of the coverage that we have been tackling today over at sltrib.com. That does it for Behind the Headlines, a co-production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks once more for tuning in. Have a great Easter. Join us again next week.